He kōna I purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
This is Media Watch. I'm Colin Peacock. As we've heard a lot lately, TV news and current affairs shows here are becoming a bit of an endangered species as our two biggest TV broadcasters cut them back to the bare minimum. But in Australia, there's vigorous competition and even a poisonous kind of rivalry that's costing one channel dearly in court. And it might happen again because of some pretty loose reporting of the deadly violence in Sydney recently.
Seven apologises for any distress caused by our earlier reports. We'll have more from the scene later this afternoon.
But first, we also now have a new media minister because that's how the Prime Minister rolls. But when will the government roll out that plan they say they've been working on?
Apologies for delaying the Press Gallery AGM. My government, as you know, is relentlessly focused on getting New Zealand back on track. And as issues change in prominence, I plan to adjust ministerial responsibilities to make sure that we are best set up to deliver for New Zealanders.
That was the Prime Minister apologising to political reporters last Wednesday for holding a surprise media conference at the very time the Press Gallery had scheduled its own annual general meeting. But he gave the political press pack a pretty good story, as well as a bit of extra business for their AGM's agenda, a new Minister for the Media.
There are significant synergies between the Arts, Culture and Heritage portfolio, which has responsibility for New Zealand on air and also the New Zealand Film Commission, and the Media and Communications portfolio. And as such, I've asked Paul Goldsmith to take the lead on media issues for the government.
And that meant that the current Minister, Melissa Lee, was out of the role and out of the Cabinet. Now, that wasn't a huge surprise for the political reporters assembled. Melissa Lee had been under huge pressure from the media to set out some sort of response to the increasingly acute financial problems the news media face. And 10 days ago, the Prime Minister was asked if he'd considered taking the portfolio away from Melissa Lee, and he offered something short of a full-throated endorsement.
Are you considering taking her portfolios off her?
No, not at this point. No, not at all. And what I'd say to you is, you know, what she's working hard at, what the government will continue to work hard at, is what can we do?
But having made the move on Wednesday, the Prime Minister didn't criticise Melissa Lee's performance in the job that he gave her after the election, but saying he needed a more senior minister for a portfolio that was getting more complex was not exactly an endorsement either. And as Lee was the party's spokesperson on broadcasting for 6 years before she became the minister last year, she ought to have been across its complexity. And in opposition, she seemed to be, when holding to account three different Labor media ministers who also struggled with the role.
Can the minister confirm the $370 million merger of RNZ and TVNZ has no regulatory impact statement or cost-benefit analysis?
Mr Speaker, I can...
At the Parliamentary Select Committee's conducting annual reviews of state-owned RNZ and TVNZ, Lee raised the issue of cancel culture, and she also amplified angst about increasing government funding of the media, corrupting its coverage.
There is a perception that it has created a media bias, that only media that were supposedly mouthpieces for the government were getting the funding. And I'll give you a quote.
Melissa Lee campaigned hard against the Labor government's plan to create and fund a not-for-profit public media entity.
Would you move to dismantle this new entity?
Well, I think, first of all, the government needs to listen to what has actually been said at Select Committee. There are so many people who submitted, close to 1,000 people who submitted. Majority of them are actually against the merger. And I think they need to stop this.
And Melissa Lee concluded that was a solution looking for a problem which would reduce media plurality. But the National Party went into that election without a proper media policy of its own, and Melissa Lee and the government were exposed when the finances of the news media slumped in late 2023. Now, TVNZ had insisted during the media merger process that its revenue-raising powers were still strong, but just before the election, it announced an ominous round of belt-tightening, and in late February, TVNZ announced that its revenue had slumped significantly in the back half of last year. And last month, just 3 days after News Hub's owners announced its complete closure for financial reasons, TVNZ announced big cuts to its news and current affairs shows. And at that time, Lee admitted in live radio interviews that she didn't know that cuts to news programs were coming, even though she had just met executives of both broadcasters.
They did not tell me that they were cutting staff on news.
Okay, so if they cut staff on news tomorrow, that will be a surprise to you.
Well, they're talking about programming that they will have to consider. So
okay.
it's Yeah, I mean, they're considering many things.
Are they going to cut Shortland Street?
Now, the media's current money worries and long-standing structural problems are, of course, not Melissa Lee's fault, and they couldn't be fixed easily by any minister or any government for that matter. But in pointing out correctly that she had limited influence on operational matters at commercial broadcasters, Melissa Lee was accused of a tone-deaf lack of empathy.
If I could actually just snap up a solution, that would be fantastic, but I'm not a magician. And I'm trying to find a solution to modernise the industry to make sure that it is actually efficient, that there is a process happening.
And it didn't help that Melissa Lee said she was personally happy with the current level of plurality of local media, even after TVNZ and News Hub's cuts were announced. Another problem that Lee's predecessors didn't have to quite the same extent was the unhelpful coalition partners. Her fellow TVNZ shareholding minister David Seymour even took the opportunity of the media crisis to single out TVNZ's political reporting of himself. And the government's other key coalition partner, New Zealand First Winston Peters, has also been a frequent and strident critic of the media, who even hinted at wanting to take the broadcasting portfolio himself to, in his words, sort out corrupt TVNZ in a now notorious election period interview. But while the media were not expecting magic from Melissa Lee, they did want some idea of what it was she said she was working so hard on for the benefit of the entire media sector, into which, incidentally, the government injects more than $250 million of public money every year. But she often seemed either unwilling or unable to respond meaningfully to questions, even on matters concerning state-owned TVNZ, of which Melissa Lee was a shareholding minister. Melissa Lee did tell the media that broadcasting legislation was out of date, and she picked out the Broadcasting Act of 1989, but it wasn't clear how reform of that could actually help struggling commercial media companies. The Fair Digital News Bargaining Bill currently before Parliament could help by pressuring Meta and Google to pay for the local news they carry on their services. But that bill was not one of the many that the government wanted to progress under urgency in its first 100 days, and there was nothing media relevant in the government's recently released action plan for the coming quarter either. Now, journalists who were asking Melissa Lee for more detail about all this were on a hiding to nothing. She cancelled interviews with Media Watch and the New Zealand Herald, claiming they would be boring because she would have so little to say about her plans. And when doorstepped by political reporters at Parliament, Lee would only barely acknowledge the existence of any plans, while at the same time insisting she was working hard on them.
There is a cabinet paper, and I won't talk about the process.
Yes, but can you understand the problem here is that if you're talking about something that's gone to cabinet, but it hasn't gone to cabinet, then actually it hasn't gone to cabinet.
I won't talk about the process.
And responses like that prompted the spin-off's editor, Toby Manhire, to ponder whether some sort of super injunction was at play, precluding any mention of the story, let alone any denials or details. So will any of that change under a new media minister? Now, when asked about his media plans on Anzac Day on News Talk ZB, the Prime Minister was little more forthcoming than Melissa Lee had been.
We won't be getting into that. Essentially, Paul Goldsmith will do a reset and think through what we can do to make sure that we support and create the conditions and the settings for media companies to innovate and adjust to what is a very difficult and changing media environment.
Now, at the time of his appointment, Paul Goldsmith was winging his way to Europe on business as Justice Minister, but he did speak to Morning Report's Ben Strang from Geneva on Friday.
And, you know, some real challenges out there. So part of the solution is to try and level the playing field as best we can between, you know, what you might describe as traditional providers and the streamers, recognising that, you know, people's behaviours have changed, and so there has to be adaptation as well. And, you know, obviously as a new minister coming in, I'll spend a bit of time talking to, you know, the key players and form my own opinions as well. And so it'll take a little bit of time, but I'm conscious of the fact that there's, you know, some urgency in some matters that we've got to deal with. You know, you've got some, you know, real challenges naturally with the massive power that the big streaming companies have and the impact that that's having on revenue. And like I say, people have to adapt. And from a government point of view, we've got to do what we can to try and level the playing field as best we can.
So could that include legislating so that Facebook and Google, these big online platforms, have to pay New Zealand media companies as they do in Australia?
Well, I mean, that's obviously something that some countries have done, and obviously it's the sort of thing that we'd be looking at.
Public Interest Journalism Fund, is that another thing that you could bring back? Is that something that in hindsight was fairly helpful to the media?
I'm not going to run through a list of hard statements, on the second day of the portfolio, but there are a range of issues you've got to work your way through. I'm going to do that in as timely fashion as I can.
Now, I understand Melissa Lee had done quite a bit of work on some plans that she intended to show Cabinet around, how to help save the industry. Have you seen those plans, and will you be tweaking and that sort of thing?
I'm not going to talk about the sort of Cabinet process, but yes, obviously work has been done, and obviously I'll be building on that work.
And there was a suggestion that maybe those plans hadn't been approved or shown to Winston Peters. Will that be something that you'll be making sure you do in future?
The coalition's working very well at the moment, and we're going to do our bit, and I'm going to sort of carry on in that vein.
New Media Minister Paul Goldsmith talking there to Ben Strang on RNZ's Morning Report on Friday. And we'll hear more about that Australian situation with the legislation that makes Meta and Google pay for journalism in a minute. But while some in the media may now be pleased that Chris Luxon has put one of his, to use his words, aces in place in the media portfolio, Paul Goldsmith will have pressing concerns in other places too. He's also the Minister of Justice and State-Owned Enterprises and Treaty of Waitangi Negotiations, as well as Arts, Culture and Heritage Minister. But while those portfolios are all deemed more important than broadcasting and media, any media plans, even modest ones, will raise expectations and will be targeted by opponents. Well, the Prime Minister has repeatedly said that bailouts or further subsidies for commercial media will not be on the table. But in addition to the Fair Digital News Bargaining Bill, still before Parliament, the government could give broadcasters a break on the $40 million annual cost of transmission fees that are payable to the state-owned company Kordia. The New Zealand Herald reported this week that that was discussed when the former Minister Melissa Lee met broadcasters just 2 weeks ago. And the idea of some form of levy on online advertising or digital transactions to fund the media could also be considered. On Midweek Media Watch this week, Hayden Donnell took a look at some of the options and other reshuffle reaction when he spoke to Emile Donovan on Nights here on RNZ National. If you missed it, Midweek Media Watch is available on the Media Watch page of the RNZ website, our section of the RNZ app, or it's available for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Our breaking news this hour, arrests made after counter-terror raids across Sydney. Live to Annie Pullar in our newsroom. Annie, what did police reveal this afternoon?
And the state's joint counter-terrorism team and AFP officers carried out these sweeping raids across Sydney's southwest, leading to the arrest of seven people, with a further five right now being questioned.
That was Australia's Channel 7 live on Wednesday with news of what were called anti-terror raids in Sydney. And Channel 7's reporter Annie Puller went on to say this.
Only our cameras were there as 13 search warrants were carried out across multiple suburbs with dozens of people interrogated, and the dog squad also deployed just after 11 this morning.
Now, just how a national TV network's cameras were in the right place at the right time during a secret anti-terror op wasn't explained, but the fact that they were was a big win for 7 News in Australia's highly competitive news media market. Now, those raids and arrests were prompted by a shocking incident last week in which a Sydney cleric was stabbed during a sermon that was streamed live on YouTube, and that sparked riots in the neighbourhood later. And moments later in that live Channel 7 news special, the Deputy Commissioner of New South Wales Police said this.
AFP Police Commissioner Rhys Kershaw has today been very clear about disinformation and misinformation that has been circulating online about 2 distressing incidents in Sydney. I urge all Australians to seek their information from reputable news sources.
But in the reporting of those 2 incidents, Australian news outlets that most people would regard as credible, including Channel 7, didn't always make that distinction themselves, as we'll hear. Now, the first and worst of those violent incidents was when a 40-year-old man called Joel Couchy killed several women and injured other people with a knife in a Bondi shopping mall, seemingly out of the blue. And here, that shook Wellington's News Talk ZB morning host Nick Mills as well.
Son, he didn't look like someone you'd think, gosh, I better be careful of him, I better keep away from him, I better watch out for him. He looked like the Joe Bloggs walking down, except he had a big stinking knife with him and wanted to stab people. And should we be doing more to make sure that people that have got these psychological issues are not on the street?
Well, maybe we should, but Nick Mills told his listeners all that was front of mind for him after a Saturday morning stroll in the Wellington suburb of Kilburnie.
But there is a lot of people that are not of sound mind walking the streets in Kilburnie, a lot, and other streets in Wellington. You know what they said about that supposed killer in Australia? The police knew about him, never been arrested, never had a meeting with the police, but they knew about him. So doesn't that scare you a little bit?
Now, predictably, there was plenty of similar comment in Australia after the Bondi tragedy. But when the police in Sydney told the media that 40-year-old Joel Cauchy had mental health issues, they did that in part to calm fears that terrorism might be in play. But it was not so when that knife attack in the Sydney church took place that same weekend. That was terrorism motivated by religious extremism, according to New South Wales Police, prompting Checkpoint's Lisa Owen to ask Australian reporter Peter Ryan this question.
Peter, you are a long-time Sydney resident. Have you ever kind of seen this level of violence before?
Well, Lisa, not at this level for a very long time. For this level of distress and high emotion and anxiety, you really need to go back to the Port Arthur massacre in Tasmania back in 1996, where there was a lone gunman who killed a dozen people, shot them dead.
But in fact, you don't have to go outside of Sydney, let alone as far back as the previous millennium, for the last time terror struck the city.
A day and a night when the whole nation seemed to hold its breath. A lone gunman and 18 innocent people being held against their will.
There was 60 Minutes on Australia's Channel 9 on the Lindt Cafe siege back in 2014, in which three people, including a gunman motivated by Islamic extremism, died in the heart of Sydney. And when terror returned to the city this month, Australian TV broadcasters didn't all cover themselves in glory covering it.
There is a major emergency unfolding at Bondi Junction, and it's centred on the Westfield Shopping Centre. We understand that at least six people have either been stabbed or shot dead.
As the TV network switched to live coverage, Rupert Murdoch's news.com.au was asking, was this a terrorist attack? And as unverified mobile phone images circulated on social media, one X account with almost 1 million followers shared what it called the first picture of the terrorist. This claimed people were being stabbed in a shopping mall in a Jewish area, and right-wing provocateur Avi Yemeni, who calls himself Osraeli Avi on Twitter, published that message to his 560,000 followers on the platform. Condemnation of the terrorist then erupted online, along with some demands for the deportation of himself and family members. But football shirt-clad Joel Cauchy wasn't a foreign terrorist. He and his family were Australian. New South Wales Police made that clear in a press conference on Saturday evening, confirming that mental health problems were the issue and not terrorism. Meanwhile, some media were publishing what they could find about the victims.
She was an incredible athlete. She was so smart, so beautiful, and she was just so excited to be a new mother. And all of that was ripped away in seconds here.
Well, that woman, Ashley Good, had in fact already died in hospital, but while her baby's life was still in the balance, the Australian media aired photos of both and published personal details galore taken without consent from Ashley Good's Instagram account. Some blurred the images of the baby's face, though Sydney's own top-selling paper, The Daily Telegraph, didn't bother. A pro-Putin ex-user calling himself Aussie Cossack wrongly claimed the Bondi attacker was a young university student in Sydney who happened to look a bit like the much older killer. And Channel 7's morning show Sunrise went with that.
The attacker, 40-year-old Benjamin Cohen.
10 minutes later, a Sunrise reporter named the Sydney student again live on the air.
For the attacker, 40-year-old Benjamin Cohen is known to police.
And it was 2 hours later that police confirmed it was actually 40-year-old Joel Cauchy. And they said this.
No evidence we have recovered, no intelligence that we have gathered that would suggest that this was driven by any particular motivation, ideology or otherwise.
Well, Channel 7 later claimed it had apologised for what it called a human error, but 4 more hours would pass before the record was corrected on the air.
7 apologises for any distress caused by our earlier reports. We'll have more from the scene later this afternoon.
Yeah, that's an important correction. Thank you for doing that, Sarah Jane.
Evidently, it wasn't important enough to rush that on the air with the same haste as the wrong name, which was pumped out online, as we heard, by notoriously unreliable and highly political sources. Now, the failure to verify politically and commercially motivated misinformation at a time of maximum risk and distress could end up costing Channel 7. The wrongly identified student Benjamin Cohen told Sky News this.
What's even more disappointing to me is a major news network doing this, using my name without waiting for a statement from the police to verify this or going out to try verify it themselves.
And after that, Benjamin Cohen engaged two of Australia's foremost defamation lawyers. And on Friday, one of them issued a statement saying that Cohen had reached a settlement with Channel 7. Now, the terms of that were confidential, the lawyer said, but it's certain to have been expensive. And it won't be the only big bill the Seven Media company will have to pay for some of its dubious decisions recently in pursuit of getting a sensational scoop for TV.
Breaking, Bruce Lerman loses his defamation case against Network 10 and Lisa Wilkinson. Justice Michael Lee making this bombshell judgment.
Mr. Lerman raped Miss Higgins. By haste and distress, this is a finding on the balance of probabilities.
Last year, Seven got in behind Bruce Lerman, a political staffer accused of rape by another, Brittany Higgins, after her claims had been aired on the rival TV channel 10. And after Lerman's trial for the rape of Brittany Higgins was abandoned because of misconduct by a juror, Lerman appeared on Seven's current affairs show Spotlight to deny it, opening the show pretty bullishly.
Liam, morning.
You ready?
Let's light some fires.
But Lerman and Channel 7 only further torched their own reputations and finances when Lerman sued Channel 10 and its presenter Lisa Wilkinson for defamation. And other damaging facts about Channel 7 emerged during the case. For example, Channel 7 paid Bruce Lerman's $2,000 a week rent bill for an entire year in exchange for two exclusive interviews. And the Spotlight Show's nomination for the coveted Walkley Journalism Award for Scoop of the Year was withdrawn as a result of that. A producer on Spotlight claimed that in securing Bruce Lerman exclusively, they also spent money on drugs and at a brothel. And Spotlight's executive producer resigned shortly after that. Now, in this month's ruling knocking back Bruce Lerman's defamation claims, Justice Lee also had reservations about Channel 10's handling of the story. He said Channel 10 didn't do enough to evaluate Brittany Higgins' evidence or seek comment from Bruce Lerman or other people involved in the events.
I find it fell short of this standard for a number of reasons. They resolved from the start to publish the exclusive story and were content to do the minimum required to reduce unacceptable litigation risk.
The judge said that that meant Channel 10's second line of defence of qualified privilege would have failed had it been needed. And there was an unexpected local angle here. Justice Lee cited the case of former Prime Minister David Longhi suing Australia's public broadcaster, the ABC. Now, way back in 1990, the ABC ran a TVNZ frontline programme for the public good, which alleged that the Labor Party, then in government, was under the influence of big businesses bankrolling the party's election campaign. That programme also sparked lawsuits here, as well as changes in TVNZ management, and current affairs were relocated from Wellington to Auckland after that. Well, as we've heard a lot lately, current affairs shows as we know them now will all but vanish soon from our screens because of the cuts at TVNZ and the impending demise of NewsHub. But in Australia, they still seem to be going strong in spite of the sort of bad editorial choices they can make, as we've heard, and the hefty legal bills and settlements that sometimes follow. Recently, the Australian news media industry website Mumbrella reported, but with tongue-in-cheek, that Channel 7 was preparing to move to the same building that houses Sydney's law courts in order to cut down on travel costs for its own executives. And that story was the work of the deputy editor Nathan Jolly. So this week, I asked Nathan about Australians' appetite for TV news and current affairs, how that fight with Elon Musk might play out, and if our new media minister should take a look across the Tasman for pointers. But first, I asked Nathan, how much of a hit will Channel 7 take for naming the wrong man as the attacker in the Bondi Mall?
It was just a very bad move. They still haven't kind of explained how it happened either. Like, obviously, it was misinformation. It was Matt Shervington, who's like one of the most popular personalities in Australia. And it got repeated. It will be something that gets dragged through the news over the following weeks.
Has that been seen as a kind of just a one-off error, you know, a human error, as I think Seven called it initially? Or is there concern here that you have highly competitive news networks and they want to get the story quickly and, you know, they seem to fall for pretty bad misinformation online, you know, malicious stuff really, yeah, without even checking?
Yeah, it's the race to get the news up first and all the checks and balances at daily considered news show or a daily newspaper. Those can't play out in the kind of time that you need anymore because they're all racing to get first. If you get it right, and you get it first, you're the heroes. As we've seen, if you get it wrong, then, you know, there's horrible fallout. That guy couldn't leave his house because he was falsely named based off clearly just internet conjecture that was then reported as fact, then repeated.
Yeah, in fact, you had a line in one of your stories about it. You said the general public either don't know what happened or just find it all a bit sleazy, because it is sleazy, but the Sunrise Show, which made the mistake, will continue to be number one. Seven News will continue to be number one. Clearly, there's still, you know, an appetite for these sorts of news shows.
Yeah, they still rate really well in Australia. You know, they're kind of tabloid magazine-y in format. Morally, they go kind of beyond the pale a lot of times. There's a lot of trickery involved in getting various stories. They'll pay money, you know, as we've seen with the Bruce Lehman stuff. They paid like $104,000 in rent for him just to get the scoop. There's a lot of money on the line, a lot of money spent on them. Ethically, they fall short a lot of the times and the networks get sued.
But it is amazing for journalists here to hear about this. Payments such as that, you know, six-figure sums to secure the cooperation of someone like Bruce Lehman at the heart of a big news controversy. Because here, our TV companies are saying we cannot afford the cost of these programs. So in Australia, it's still worth the boss's while pumping big money into these shows to get people to watch on television?
Yeah, they do rate well. Like I said, there's A Current Affair, which is the one that Nine has, that rates well every night. The Sunday Project rates less well, but the project is kind of their figurehead show at 10. And Spotlight, which is the 7 one, is the one that's kind of been embroiled in recent controversy as well. That also rates well. So they're all competing hard in that kind of arena. And we've seen it drag through the courts what they will and won't do.
Yeah, the two extraordinary cases there, both involving the Seven company. So there was Bruce Lehman, who we mentioned also last year, Ben Robert Smith, you know, formerly an Australian war hero, or cast as such for what he did in Afghanistan. Channel 9 and Fairfax News investigating him for war crimes. Horribly messy, but both those two guys tried to sue the broadcasters that had tried to tell the true story about him. Were these sort of genuine attempts to clear the names of those two guys, or was it actually rivalry between, you know, big TV broadcast companies that was behind those defamation cases?
Yeah, I mean, well, certainly Kerry Stokes, who owned Seven, paid the costs for Ben Robert Smith to sue the Nine papers. So something else at play as well, as you pointed out. But in Australia as well, the defamation laws, like, it's quite easy to sue and it's quite easy to be sued for defamation. And so there's a lot of defamation lawsuits that you wouldn't have in America. Like, I'm not sure what the laws are like in New Zealand, but, you know, at the moment, Elon Musk is fighting this Twitter takedown and his whole platform is based on free speech. And it's like, we don't have free speech in Australia. That's not part of our constitution. It's part of the American constitution. And because of that, like, our defamation laws are such that Ben Robert Smith can sue and Bruce Lehman can sue, and it just drags all this stuff through the courts and millions of dollars are spent and everyone comes out of it badly.
Is there a sense then that even if they're a bit too tabloid, it's a bit like with the British tabloid papers, fear of exposure is actually a public good in the end. If you do something that's going to look terrible on a show like that, it is actually a disincentive to do it. And that's one of the things people here are saying, if we lose all our TV news current affairs shows, dodgy conduct will go unchecked. So even if these shows are, you know, a bit morally on the edge in Australia, is there a public support for them being broadly a good thing?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good argument. But, you know, hopefully serious journalistic endeavours can step in and do that role.
Yeah, but the problem here is that those are the ones that are going, the ones that do the non-tabloid stuff. And so programs that will remain here in New Zealand that do news outside of a 6 p.m. sort of news summary bulletin are going to be the ones that do what are called here integrations. So there's stuff within the program that's kind of bought by commercial clients. So is there a lot of that in Australia too?
Yeah. In the morning programs there are. Like, you'll have someone like Carl Stefanovic, who hosts Today, just drop in a, isn't Macca's great? Like, that blatantly. I guess people accept that because they're seen more as light. There's news bulletins in there, but there's also pop singers on there to talk about their new album. So it's a bit more of a magazine-y type show. And as such, I suppose those integrations are accepted, but yeah, it's not uncompromised.
Yeah. And as you say, it still pulls a crowd in Australia, because you pointed out on Mumbrella that on the day they wrongly named the student Benjamin Cohen. They'd put out an item afterwards boasting about the huge ratings and being number one for that day and across Australia, which, as you pointed out, it showed how widely Benjamin Cohen was, in fact, defamed.
Yeah, here's some concrete figures on how many people heard the wrong man named. Yeah, it was madness.
And in terms of court cases and legal struggles, yeah, you're going to have an epic one, Elon Musk and the Australian government.
The Prime Minister has called Elon Musk an arrogant billionaire for refusing federal court orders to take down graphic video of the Wakeley church stabbing from his social media platform X.
In the federal court, the eSafety Commissioner won an injunction, that order forcing X, formerly known as Twitter, to remove the footage for the next 2 days. The court found X hadn't complied. Anthony Albanese fired his own shots this morning, calling Musk arrogant.
This isn't about censorship. It's about common sense and common decency. And Elon Musk should show some.
Well, that could be huge, couldn't it, have international implications?
I think he seems to just fundamentally misunderstand what the ban is and why it's a good idea, etc. He literally owns Twitter, or X as it's called now. If he wants to amplify this as one of his issues, he will. But Albanese's also taking the bait, and it's not bad for him. You know, he's taking on like a megalomaniac billionaire who's very unsympathetic. You know, Albo will only come across well in this fight. So it's almost a good thing for the Australian government, because they show that they're strong on this kind of international corporations.
We have a brand new broadcasting minister in this country this week. The one thing the new minister has said is that we've got to level the playing field with the digital operators, citing the streamers, also the likes of Google and Facebook. Now, in Australia, you have had laws in place for a couple of years which have forced the likes of Google and Meta to bargain with news media and pay them for news. In Australia, has it broadly worked out? And do you think our government should basically copy what you've got?
I think those laws have been, if not wound back, then Facebook are arguing against them at the moment. But we have a prominence framework that's currently being argued, where they're trying to get the Australian free-to-air networks prominent placement on connected TVs and things like that. So when people turn on their TVs, they're not just hit with Netflix and Disney and YouTube logos. Like, it'll show the local logos. Something like that, I think, is important for the future of the local broadcasters, and it would be very easy for someone to just have a Samsung TV, a bunch of apps, and then just not really have access to local content. Those frameworks are good, and I think those are the kind of things that government should be supporting. As for the Googles and they're kind of more amplification systems, and so if they're taking local content and amplifying it, they get the benefits. They should be paying the newsrooms for it. And I suppose that's the argument that's happening at the moment.
But is it the same position in Australia where here news media almost as one, say 90% of the digital advertising revenue approximately goes to the likes of Google and Facebook, and their local media companies are fighting over all the crumbs? Is it the same position in Australia?
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the same, which is why they're arguing that, you know, you should be paying a licensing fee, the same way that anyone else that uses content that they didn't make and benefits from it pays royalties. It makes sense. It's how media has worked for as long as it's existed.
Another thing that's proposed or that suggested that our government could look at is some kind of levy on internet service operators, you know, and streamers, the likes of Netflix and that make a fortune in New Zealand, but you know, don't pay a lot of tax or host a lot of New Zealand content. Has that argument cropped up or had any support?
Yeah, there's lots of, that's one of the big pushes. I think one of the arguments was that Netflix uses up an inordinate amount of the internet, so it's actually literally slowing down grids, and so that company should be forced to pay a premium tax-wise because they're using up what's public utility. So there's lots of arguments like that, but I think it's these big companies should be paying more taxes in the markets they operate in because they make a lot of money and, as you said, gives very little back.
And just finally, if it does come down to a Australian government, Musk versus Albanese type of legal tussle, who will be the winner?
Yeah. Albanese has to be the winner. Even if he loses in the courts, he'll still win in the minds of the Australians.
If any government is in the position of having to confront this lopsided market where, you know, these frictionless international global companies, the likes of Netflix, Google, Facebook, whatever, who are making a lot. Do you think in PR terms, any government that does stand up for that on behalf of their local media, even if local media aren't that popular, mm-hmm. judging by trust surveys, there actually is something to be gained politically by a government prepared to do it?
It's a good look, isn't it? Yeah. You're fighting the bad guys. Yeah, good luck with it all.
That was Nathan Jolly, the deputy editor of the Australian media industry news service, Mumbrella. And finally on Media Watch this week, on the program last week, Media Watch's Hayden Donnell talked about the latest survey showing a decline in trust in news here, with a former Herald editor, Marianne Alexander, and the current editor of the Otago Daily Times, Paul McIntyre. And if you missed it, you can hear it again in full wherever you get your podcasts. And if that happens to be Apple Podcasts, well, you can also read it in full, because last month, Apple Podcasts began adding verbatim transcripts to the audio. And that's handy, but it's not exactly verbatim. The technology struggles with the New Zealand accent and anything obviously in Te Reo, and the large language models sometimes pick up entirely the wrong language. For instance, in the transcript of that chat with the ODT's Paul McIntyre, it records him as saying, "We basically at a bullshit are doing what newspapers have been doing for many, many years," which clearly doesn't make sense, and it's not at all the kind of language that Paul McIntyre uses, at least not for broadcast on RNZ. But here's what Paul actually said to Hayden last week.
I suppose we basically at a bullshit, we're doing what newspapers did many, many years and have changed.
So as you heard there, the word was broadsheet, meaning the traditional large page size that most newspapers used to use to print on, and the ODT still does. So when it comes to journalism being the first draft of history, beware what the AI tools and tech create unsupervised by humans, because it can end up being, well, a load of broadsheet. Well, that's all for this week, but we'll be back with more on the media in Midweek Media Watch next Wednesday after 9:30 on Nights with Emile Donovan. And then back again with more Media Watch at the same time next weekend here on RNZ National.